Okay. I wanted to get off on a different track just for a little bit. My recollection, my early training in polymer chemistry when I was in graduate school, I was in an environment that included Bill Bailey, who was always one of the... And polycarbonates had just come into place. Polyphenylene oxide was something which they were purely academic kinds of interests. You never had much of an experience beyond here is the newest class of polymers that are being studied. Was there much interaction with the academic community? You know, this was hot stuff. There were Gordon conferences going on. There were scientific meetings. You have consultants, for example.
With PPO?
Or with polycarbonate?
With polycarbonate, we did have some interaction, I'd say from the beginning, with Dick Stein.
From UMass.
Dick Stein probably had the earliest samples of polycarbonates and knew about them. And he's been totally up to date on what's going on almost all of our polymers. I hired the first PhD candidate when I was still in Schenectady, John Keane.
Shenian, you picked up Shenian?
I picked up Shenian. Shenian and Keane were classmates at UMass, and I needed a couple guys to work on PPO. I asked Keane if he knew anybody, and he said Shenian, so that's one of the reasons I got Shenian from him. The Borman, I got him from Orange, Texas, where DuPont had sent him from West Virginia. And we had his pal, Don Jake, was with us, and Don bird-dogged him. But we picked up quite a few people. But the thing at UMass was Stein. We had some contact with Brooklyn Poly. And not a whole lot.
But with Overberger and...
Overberger, yes. Overberger and Bill Cass were buddies. And talked with a number of people, actually, quite early there, but you name them. We talked with them from Gaylord had just left, and who's the guy who went out to La Jolla?
Goodman.
Murray Goodman was a very good friend. They go on, I don't know. We had good, polycarbonates, we got a little support, interaction with Vivian Stannett, who was at Cornell at the time, down in North Carolina now. He majored crystallinity and permeability and things of this sort for us. But for the most part, there really wasn't too much interaction with academics.
Not much of a discussion going on about PPO polystyrene. It was certainly a unique discovery, and the polymer physics people, for example, was there much going on with...
Unfortunately, no. Frankly, I used to tear my hair out at the lack of interest or consideration we got from our corporate research lab. One of my classic cases that bothered me was Fraser Price, who was a great crystallographer, spent his whole career studying carbowax and polyethylene, which I used to say we don't make, use, or give a damn. I couldn't get him to look at the crystallinity of our polymers. But you can publish about carbowax, but you couldn't publish about new products. And I think that that's one of the things that bothered me there a little bit. There were a few people at the research laboratory who were involved and capable. Al Schultz was one of them. Tom McGrann came a little bit later. He was interested. George Gaines did some work for us. But for the most part, we didn't get a great deal of support from the polymer physical end. We had a fantastic amount of support from the synthetic end.
Yeah.
And that was because Al has always supported very well from the synthetic end, and that's good.
Yeah.
I mentioned and unmentioned briefly here a quickie, and that was that the I let that paper get by. It was picked up by some scientists, chemists at AKU in Netherlands, and they had a program going with their high voltage people there. I forget, they have a name for it, it's like EPRI. But they were interested in extra high voltage cable, and from a analytical standpoint, or from an actual standpoint, styrene was nearly a perfect material, but it didn't have high enough heat. And they were pressing on AKU to develop a product like styrene with higher heat. And Al's little message got out in Journal of Physics, I guess it was, and a couple of bright people there immediately jumped on it, and they started making PPO, and they started evaluating it, measuring it, characterizing it, doing a whole lot of work with it, and had actually made high voltage cable sections and tested them and things of this sort based on wrapped film of PPO. And so we ended up picking up a fair amount of useful information on it from them, and they were working very close with that Dutch association, and had a couple of polymer chemists from Utrecht who were consulting with them. So they had probably did more basic fundamental chemistry than we did at the time. We have since gotten very much involved, but in the early days, most of our program was synthetic.
Yeah. I guess there are a couple of things that I was kind of saving till the end, and I suppose I ought to throw them in here. I'm kind of interested in why GE got into the polyester business, the PBT business. I'm kind of interested in the serendipitous element of adding polyester to polycarbonate, how GE got into the composite business. And perhaps finally, at the end, we ought to just touch lightly on your views of the Ultem business and GE's getting into a really complicated kind of new chemistry there.
Okay. So I can take these.
Take whichever one you want first.
Sort of one at a time. When PPO graduated, there was a big question of what do I do next? And one of the things that our marketing people kept telling us is that we have two amorphous polymers that have great thermal stability and everything else, but they dissolve in everything. What we need is a crystalline polymer. And myself and a marketing type literally took off around the world trying to acquire a crystalline polymer. We also had a major program going on from a synthetic standpoint, trying to create a synthetic or a crystal polymer. And we did make a few things that were pretty interesting, but they weren't quite everything we wanted. And we had literally come up with, we narrowed it down to PET has all the properties we want, but not processable. And polyformaldehyde is a good possibility, and we visited Europe and had propositions from several people to get into the polyformaldehyde business. Few things that I didn't like about it, and one of the key obstacles there was DuPont didn't want anybody else in, and they had some patents. So that was sort of barred. Mm-hmm. And the nylon business at the time required too much integration. You had to go to make your own monomer, you had to make your own diamines and diacids and everything else, and that was not the type of thing we could hope to get in. So we were literally screening things in all directions, trying to find something that we could buy to get in a hurry. Then Celanese came out with a product called X71 or XP71, experimental polymer 71, I think it was, or XP70, I don't know. And an interesting thing there from is that the man who was manager of R&D for our Lexan business for quite a few years was Prochaska. Bob Prochaska was manager of our Lexan R&D for a while. He left and went to Celanese. Mm-hmm. And Celanese ended up making this XP product, which seemed to have all the properties we wanted, very fast crystallization. And we tried to analyze it and tear it apart, and we finally found out what it was PBT. And my boss at the time was Jack Walsh. And his question to me, Fox, why the hell can't we make that stuff? And I said, not a reason in the world as far as patents, because the patents ran out with Winfield Dixon.
Yeah.
And he said, Ruby, what the hell are you doing? Go make some. So we went to make some. And this is where Ken Borman came in. He was the key guy, a man on making the PBT, and we made several pounds laboriously in the laboratory. We test it, and it's great. And we're having a little conference of war in Jack's staff meeting, and what the hell are we waiting for? Why don't we commercialize it? And, well, we need a kettle or a reactor to start making larger quantities first.
Yeah.
He said, go buy one. So
yeah.
He turned to Gary Whitehouse, who was the engineer manager at the time, and asked him, where can you get a kettle? Or where can you get a reactor? And Gary says, I'll check. He left and he called Atlantic Reactor, and they said they just happened to have a 40-gallon kettle that somebody elected not to take. And they could deliver it immediately, but it cost $200,000 or $150,000. And Jack said, he'll buy it. I'll get the signatures. So we bought the kettle, had it in here in, I'd say, a matter of less than a month, and we were scaling up PBT.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made it, and it looked good, and Jack was the one who immediately said, I don't want this business if we can't get a control of the raw materials. The key raw material was PBT, or butanediol, and
Thus
started a long research program to make or generate butanediol. But we went right straight through that thing, and the thing that made it so easy was that we were calling on the customers, selling them Lexan and Noril, and where they needed solvent resistance, we had it.
Yeah.
So we completed our market basket, and it went very fast.
Yeah.
And actually, we came in late, and subsequently, probably 6 or 8 or 10 more U.S. companies came in, and they all dropped out, and or almost all, and we end up number one in the market. That was PBT.
Good market fit.
It fit perfectly.
Yeah.
The, what else was there?
Altem.
Altem, interesting story. It was around for a long, long time. And it was beautiful chemistry, but totally commercially impractical. But the research laboratory had an awful lot of effort going on it, and they kept plugging it. And we sort of kept, I would say, giving them more or less over oral commendation, but really didn't get very much involved. Because what it had was about at least 6 different distinct chemical steps, and each one of them, you might get a 90% yield. If you take 90 times 90 times 90 times 90, you end up with about a 5% overall yield. And you waste an awful lot of chemicals, an awful lot of time and equipment and stuff. It just didn't look like it had a chance for commercial success. And to show good faith, I did hire a person who kept him working for a year on the thing or so, but my heart wasn't in it.
Were you essentially against it?
I wasn't against it from a chemistry standpoint, but I think I was against it, I know I was against it, as far as a worthwhile venture for GE Plastics. And I think they sort of sensed this over the research laboratory.
In retrospect, with the Mount Vernon facility and et cetera, how do you feel about that?
Better.
Better.
Mm-hmm. And what is the status of it? Maybe we always play it up with the research development center because
it's not a big deal yet, is it? It could be billed as a great success. And it is a great success, and the market is building a lot faster than I ever thought possible, and the technology has become much greatly simplified, and we are, right now, we've sold out of our, I guess you'd call it large pilot planter semi-works facility, and we are in the process of commissioning a production facility, and we have a few good applications for it, and if they continue to look good, we'll sell that one out fast, and I guess it's destined to be a very good success.
On the level of Alexanderville?
Well, again, what you're going to talk about here is this material is selling for 3 times the price, mm-hmm. or 4 times the price, or 5 times the price for specialties or more, and therefore the volumes are going to be smaller, but it's going to be profitable, but I don't think it's going to be on the world scale as, say, polycarbonate or PPO. And it is competing for markets where there are some reasonable competitors. Mm-hmm. In fact, some damn good competitors. And fortunately, they're all in the same price range, so they're competing at a higher level. Mm-hmm. And I have no doubt that what it's going to be a good probably better than good. I know it's going to be a great business, but I think that all parties involved have done an outstanding job. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of in a position where I wasn't one of the initial champions. Maybe I am a bit biased. I'm not calling it a howling success.
Yeah.
But I will give them a lot of credit for doing a great job. And I now see where it has some markets where it can justify its cost, and some of these markets are quite large. Printed circuits being one of them, molded printed circuits. Packaging, there's a great deal of enthusiasm in our company. I don't quite share that, totally. But it's a very good product for the applications they're looking at, but I think that sooner or later some lower cost products will probably take the large volume portion of these markets. And there will still be a sizable market, but it won't be like PET Coke bottles, which are now in the 700 million pounds or 800 million pounds in 6 years, going up fast. Of course, the difference there is the price is around 60 cents a pound, and we're talking around $4 or $5 or $6 a pound. So it's going to be restricted. Interesting one on that. Where we got started, I think, is that two interesting things. One, back in 1975, we were looking for some other name or some other way to designate the thing, and the party was held over at the research lab at the guest house, and I think Beaky was there, and Warren Booty, and few others, and our bicentennial was coming up, so we decided to call it X76. This would be the experimental resin 76. We thought we might get around to maybe introducing it by then, but it took us an extra 6 years, I think, before we announced it. Slip between mouth and lip or something, but role here, I would say, I don't think there's any question that Beaky played a key role along with Jack in that. And Beaky, rumor has it, told Jack that we've given you people a lot of business over a long period of time, and we think Ultim is a great product, and I think you owe us one. And suddenly we started all that cooperative development program for them. And I would say it's been a very worthwhile, good relationship, because the people from the research lab literally came over and lived with us. We lived with them, and it's been everything you could expect or hope for in a working arrangement.
You know, maybe an interesting way to tie this whole thing into a loop. The laboratory in Schenectady was really built in the aftermath of Edison and for Steinmetz, I suppose, or by Steinmetz in the early years, in a unique way. There aren't very many laboratories like that, and so in a sense you have a unique relationship between research in support of development and then marketing driving research. You can't point to DuPont, for example, or anybody else that I can see find the same kind of working relationship that you've been describing back and forth here as we've gone from one product to the next product over your whole career, where we keep bouncing back and forth. Do you feel that's a unique kind of enterprise that GE has?
I think that this is something that GE has over all of our competitors, and that is the absolute open door between all technical people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the managerial ladders and things of this sort are pretty insignificant when you get to the technical community. I don't have to ask my boss if I may go talk to somebody over in Schenectady. I want to call up Roland Schmidt today and talk with him. And I never was without that ability. And I think that that's one of the things that's unique about GE, and that is that we do not have change of command. And I say this is one of the things that disturbed me when I went interviewed at DuPont. This man had a check with his boss, who had a check with his boss, who had a check with his boss to get final approval to say, I'd like to have you come to work. And I guess this bothered me, having to act through intermediaries, or intermediaries, in trying to make things happen. And this is the thing that we have done a great job here. In making things happen, no question about it. The other thing I would say, if you want to characterize GE Plastics, is that somebody had the foresight many years ago, and it was Bob Gibson, I think, to start a chemical development operation whose sole purpose in life was to start new businesses. And this concept is not, the idea of having a chemical development function is not different, but all the chemical development functions I've encountered are staff functions with maybe a marketing man or somebody else in charge. And in order to make anything happen, they must go and interrupt somebody else who has a job that he's being measured on and say, would you drop your job and do some work for me on this, or would you do this, or would you do that? And nobody will ever do that on a voluntary basis. So all they are is a staff function with no muscle. And in the GE chemical development operation, it was put together with a manager of R&D, a manager of engineering, a finance man, a legal man, and what the hell else we have? We have every function, and every one of the functions has some people who can make things happen and can buy equipment and establish equipment, do whatever the hell they need to make things happen. And this makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That no longer exists, though, does it? It finally went out of... there is no such thing.
Well, I'd say we sort of lost it, but not completely, because I think that what Joe has is a good remnant of it. He has me, and right now I'm working on new polymers and new products. And I have an engineering counterpart in this chemist downstairs who is able to work on the engineering part of polymers. We have all of the technical facilities of the General Electric Company that we can work on. And we have some funds, and we are supporting work at Louisville, and we are contributing to work where we can call the plays at the research laboratory over and above our our assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go outside and hire outside companies, and we can operate this as a unit with literally Joe having that as a chemical development.
So that's sort of loose enough. I don't know if you read that Search for Excellence book,
yes,
which has an absurd little paragraph about the history of Lexan, and credit says it's a total bootlegged operation. I was just reminded me, you said the CDO, they made it sound like you were carrying this thing out in secret and against everyone. That's total fiction, isn't it? In addition to getting all the names wrong, they also got the facts.
A lot of fiction. just nice that you spelled my name right.
Yeah, right. It's easier than which I think they spelled with an S.
33 years into your career here.
I guess so.
As you look back on it, what gives you the greatest pleasure in 30 seconds or less?
The thing that gives me the greatest pleasure is to contemplate all the people who are working because I started something, without any question.
Nicely said.
And that's kind of exciting. And the tape is done. I would say the other thing is right now I am in